One, two, three. That counts us into hour two of the Creative City Show here on 1030 The Voice Tucson. We are halfway through our Thursday edition of the show, where we daily talk about the stories and strategies of the people and ideas shaping Tucson's future. We cover everything from housing to entrepreneurship to business development to sustainability to water and urban planning. We cover seven of those big topics here on the air. Day in and day out, we envision, debate, and discuss those issues. And we do it together. 790-2040 is that live line where that can happen. And I like to say, if you haven't listened to the show recently, I like to say that the power of local radio is that it is the only real-time feedback loop about issues that matter. I say comically, if you read a newspaper and disagree, you write an editorial and hope someone publishes it. If you are on a blog, you disagree or you agree, write a comment and hope somebody sees it. Radio is that place where you get to call in and interact. And my only rule is that the feedback and comments and opinions have to be decent and polite, but any opinion is a good opinion. My style is to let you speak your mind and what's on your mind. I'm not the interrupter. People tell me I should cut things off sooner, and for better or for worse, that's my style, is to have a real conversation on the air. And I think people appreciate that opportunity to get to talk things out. And again, my only rule is that it has to be good and clean and polite. Other than that, we are a forum. We are a free market for ideas, right, Bob? We are a free market for ideas. And that's what the public space should be. Well, if you're just jumping into the show here today, I have been talking about some ideas, a kind of a thesis for Tucson, and that is we should be really focused on taking care of the house we have before trying to build another room on. And that metaphor goes for a lot of things in communities. At the beginning of the week, I talked about the Pima County proposal to take $26 million from the general fund to fund road repair. States around the country, they spend about $20 billion to repair current roads, and they spend about $20 billion to make new roads. So jurisdictions have this really bad habit of building before they've figured out what they've already gotten. And I see that at a state level. I see that at a city level. I see that at county levels. And I certainly see that in all three of those here in our state and in our city and our region. So I talked about how we do that, and I kind of kicked it off with my opinion on annexation. I'm actually fascinated by communities who are de-annexing because they realize that sometimes the addition of people and land and businesses brings in upfront state shared revenues and other revenue streams, but it's a net-net or a net loss because cities have to actually take care of that infrastructure and take care of those people. And so if you don't have it right with what you got, you're not going to have it right with what you're about to get, and that is a philosophy. And then I went into, okay, if we're going to take care of our house, whether it's planning or police or roads, what are some resources we might be able to reallocate, or what partnerships might we be able to have in the community to get there? And that's what takes us to this 11 o'clock hour. A good friend and a smart person focused on community and economic development, Iris Patton, is in the studio. And we're going to talk about this today, right? We looked at the Tucson budget in the first hour. We looked at what we got. And we're going to talk about this in 11 o'clock hour. How do we expand our pie? Local governments are far from broke. Do not believe it. Local governments are far far from broke. They just don't tap into what they've got through collaborative partnerships, their enormous market power. And under the last few federal administrations, cities get less and less and less traditional revenue. And it's really having to make cities innovate on how we grow our pie, not just manage the one we have, but to grow our resource pie to take care of our city and our people and our infrastructure. And so Iris was kind enough to join this hour to talk about just that, talk about private and civic wealth, public wealth, social impact funds, and more. So I'm excited to get into it. Iris, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good. It's my pleasure.
Yeah. So this is one of those fun things about what I get to do is I'll get to say, hey, friend ABC, 123 XYZ, guess what I'm going to talk about today? You might be interested. And sometimes they go, well, you should have me on to talk about it. And I'll go, well, yes, why didn't I think of such a thing? And here we are. So could you just introduce yourself to those listening? We've had you on the show before, but if for any first-time listeners to you, give us the lowdown on who Iris Patton is to get started.
Sure. And actually, since the last time I was here, we've changed a bit. So this is perfect timing. So my name is Iris Patton, and I'm the founder and CEO of Rogue Impact. We used to be Geospatial Collaborative. As of June 1st, we will be officially Rogue Impact. And we are a data-driven and action-oriented institute where research and application converge. And so we use mapping technology, policy, and community investment to increase opportunity and diminish inequity and inequality. We work with communities to figure out what are some opportunities to help them achieve a higher well-being and higher quality of life. And then we connect resources in terms of nonprofit agencies and other organizations that can help them achieve their goals. And we connect them with the funds, the resources to actually get it done.
Right. And you work with cities all over the country. You're here locally at the moment, but you work with cities all over the country.
Yes. And actually, we just picked up Nashville this week.
Hey, incredible. I was talking about Nashville a couple of weeks ago on the show.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah.
It's an interesting place.
It is.
Yeah. I'll be taking my first visit out there in like 2 weeks. So,
what makes it interesting?
Because, you know, it's funny. People think of, or at least my perception of Nashville was that it's a high wealth city. Uh-huh. It is diverse in terms of ethnicity. But, you know, you think of like the music, you think that it is this very popular and progressive and high quality of life place. What I've learned over the past couple of weeks is we've been exploring working there. And then this past week, as we've started to reach out to local organizations, we've realized that actually the disparity between rich and poor is very wide and the need is extremely great. And those are things that you don't see in the newspapers or on the Grammy shows. And so it's trying to figure out how to address those issues. I was talking to someone who's head of a nonprofit there, and she was telling me about some of their crime issues. Mm. And honestly, the crime rates in Nashville kind of compete with those out of Chicago, which you hear about often. And again, you know, these are stories that you don't hear.
Right.
And you'd never expect that it would come out of a place like Nashville, but
right.
It is.
I was talking with a guy by the name of Ben Bueller Garcia. He's been around the city for a minute, and we were talking about he's another economic and community development kind of expert and consultant. We were talking about how cities can promote inclusive growth, and the phrase we were talking about is how do cities deliver a broad-based prosperity, right? So as communities and cities grow, there's often winners and losers.
Yeah.
I bring that up because you talk about Nashville and the gap. You know, we talk about it as it's a thriving city. It's checking economic boxes. Its brand is amazing. And when you dig in, there's this massive kind of gap between, you know, who has resources. My question is there any city that doesn't have that problem? That seems to be a city problem.
Yeah, and the thing is, and that's just it, every city does have the problem, but it's how do you address that issue? And it's also, I think, important to keep in mind that the end goal isn't to make every resident wealthy. It's to provide the opportunities for residents to have a livable quality of life. so that the opportunities are there if they so choose to access them, to have have quality education, to have opportunities for a diverse pool of jobs if they so want. So either they can have a job or they can have a career, but the ceiling is not low. It's having that access. The access is important. You're right in that a lot of cities are starting to recognize the gap in their disparity. A couple years ago, the University of Florida commissioned a study for Gainesville, Florida, where they're located, and they're one of the largest employers in a 7-county area around their own county. And they commissioned this study to help measure this gap, and the results of which, you know, in that case, the Black residents who they were working with were like, you know, no duh, we know that life is really hard here for us. The university was partnered on the project with six other economic development interested agencies, as well as local government. And they were like, well, we knew that there was a problem too, because, you know, they're having issues with getting trained staff from within, you know, same issues as every city, right? But they didn't recognize the depth of the problem. And I think that's the issue with a lot of cities, is that, okay, we know we have a problem, we just don't understand the severity of it. And so how do we then move forward from this information and start to address it? In some cities, they've chosen to import talent as the way to address it or mitigate it. That's not the answer either. I mean, and there's a lot of value in bringing outside talent and jobs in, a huge amount of value. But you also need to start at home and figure out, how can I start to improve the quality of my residents and of my communities that are already here, instead of starting all over again?
Right. I wanted to get your thoughts on this in a fun way, because this was the theme of my first hour, is how do we take care of our house and who's here already? And I feel like cities have this bad habit of thinking that everything and everyone outside is a greener grass than investing internally.
It's like a bad
relationship. Cities have some really bad habits. And then when they look and learn at other cities, sometimes those bad habits get shared. But this is sometimes my view on, like, the annexation conversation is yes, in the short term, you can add more state shared revenue, but if you're not solving the problems that you have currently, you're not going to get places that want that want to annex in. And once they do, you're just expanding the amount of problem that you have. And I just feel like we look at those kind of conversations with the short term gain in mind without realizing that if you're just building a house, building a room on a shaky house, you're going to have more shaky house. Am I onto something, or am I missing something, or what's your view on that?
No, you're totally onto it. And there's so many pieces that are part of it that often cities don't recognize. So again, you know, their focus is this short-term gain. You know, I have no money. It's similar to, like, a person who has no money. You have a choice. Either you can stop what you're doing, kind of focus on how can I develop a plan for a sustainable source of income. Or do I just need to go out and, you know, do something quick for money that may solve my immediate need, but tomorrow I'm still going to need money again? And so it's the same, and you know, not just the problem of needing money, but then what other pieces contribute to that larger problem? So as cities, it's yes, you know, we can invest all this money in specific areas. All these people are coming here. You know, we're showing these gains in terms of average incomes and average housing prices, and construction is up, and all these things, right? These indicators that supposedly are supposed to be the ones that that indicate the health of a city. But in the meantime, what have you done for the residents that are already there? Have your interventions caused resentment? Are the neighbors now feeling as though they don't care anymore because they've invested in this community for so long, but they're getting nothing in return because the city government or management is so focused on these short-term gains? It's a bad mix. and at the end of the day, again, you know, kind of going back to the example of, you know, do I just get a quick fix to solve my immediate financial issue, or do I look at something long-term? The problem typically is that the city or the community or whomever, there's no vision. There's no picture of, what am I trying to get to? And then what are the steps that it's going to take me to get there? And am I willing to be patient in order to get there? And then are there pieces of, you know, I may not get exactly what I want immediately, but there are gains that need to be celebrated in the meantime. And that's a challenge.
And how do you communicate that?
Bingo.
So in the last hour, I talked about how the $6 million budget for PTSD in Tucson needs to be expanded.
Yeah.
Not to create more bureaucracy, but because the planning, visioning, public-facing communication side is sorely lacking. And that's not new information to anybody, city included. But that's that communication method has been so difficult. So as Tucson is growing and as fewer people are feeling that growth in the short term, at least, there's a huge dissension, and it just creates this neighborhood versus developer tension. Yeah. That narrative gets expanded, and it's a lot of problems.
You know, the other piece to that, though, is that, you know, at some point, especially in cities like Tucson, where over, I would say like the past 8 to 12 years, it's kind of been this correction. So ever since, you know, the housing crisis happened, and then it's been multiple administrations where they've just been trying to stabilize the government and the city, which was needed, right? But now you're at a point where it's like, okay, everything for the most part is stable, but how do we move forward? I think the challenging part about all of this is that there's a little bit of self-reflection that needs to occur too, in the sense of the government, local governments need to realize, am I the one that's going to have a full role in how we move forward, or do I need to focus on one specific thing, stabilize that, and iteratively improve and increase the scale and scope of the services that I provide? In the meantime, do I need to allocate deter some of these other roles that we need or other jobs that we need done? Do I need to then shift them over to private organizations to get them done? And then at some point, we'll catch up together. And, you know, then, you know, I'll take them back as I have the capacity to do so. And it's that self-reflection of admitting, I can't do this all myself.
Right.
I need help. And maybe the private structure is the way to actually help me do that.
I love it. Either on purpose or on accident, you queued up the next segment, because that's what I want to talk about is, so for example, like in Cincinnati, there's, I believe it's Cincinnati, Center City Development Corporation, the municipal government and private corporations actually came together and formed a 501c3 to funnel in private money to take care of public-private needs.
But they do this everywhere.
I know. This is why you're in studio, Iris, is because you know and you've seen it. I don't think it's hit Tucson yet. And that's why we're kind of vision casting it and catalyzing a little bit on the air. Let's jump off of what you just said in our next segment. What are some ways that you're seeing around the country that these kind of public-private funding methods are being used to expand the pie of resources, right? I said this on the air, this property sales tax expansion, sales tax rate going up, does it go down? Passé. These are old conversations. Yep. We manage the pie we have. We got to expand as well with some of these other methods.
Yeah.
We're going to get into it on the other end of the hour. Before we go, I just want to bring this up. It's interesting. This is just a commentary. My last thing on annexation, but it relates.
Go for it.
So Memphis more than doubled in physical size between 1960 and 2016. The city absorbed more than 200 square miles of land into its boundaries during that time frame, growing to 340 square miles. This is the money line. The decline in population density that accompanied the city's growth put a strain on city services that were being delivered over a significantly larger area. This is not rocket science.
No, it's not.
When you bring more people in, you have to serve more people.
Yeah.
If you don't have the ability to serve more people, why are you going to serve more people? I mean, it's just...
But here's the thing, though.
We have to think about how cities are designed.
True.
We're not thinking city design.
But if you think about the way... And I apologize for not tuning into your last hour. But, you know, if you think about it, annexation, even in planning school, and I used to teach this, annexation is taught as a way to increase city revenues, right?
It's a revenue driver.
Exactly.
But only.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. But that's, again, this idea of a short-sighted solution to a very long-term and sustainable issue. You will always have people in your cities. So if you're thinking that, oh, I have a bill that's due, the way to do it is to get more people to, you know, pay into me being able to support this bill.
Kicking the can down the road.
You are. Because then once that bill is paid, you still have to support the population.
Yep.
And no one thinks like that. It's a very short time horizon. The other challenge, sorry, I know we have to go, but the other challenge is that time horizon. you know, we're often thinking in terms of administrations, you know, whether that's the planning administration or the mail administration or, you know, whatever timeline that's there. And solutions need to be generated, which I think is an incentive for these public-private partnerships, because then there's accountability beyond a mayor's term or beyond, you know, a governor's term or a president's term. It's, you know, at the end of the day, we need to continue to do good and serve our community, regardless of who's in office, regardless of what their politics are. We have to continue to serve and work toward this vision.
Right. I think it's one thing that Tucson as a weak mayor system may actually have a leg up on versus a strong mayor system is that at least, I know I'm giving a lot of credit, at least there is a city manager that can span terms,
yes,
that has a lot of power in a weak mayor system. Whereas if you have a strong mayor system, it's CEO driven and you're kind of, you're based on the agenda of that strong, I know I'm simplifying things.
No, it's okay. But and so you're correct in the sense of the having the city manager remain as that administrative figure that's for the continuity. But then you have to remember that the council is also a very important piece of that. You have to have a supportive councilor that, again, is working toward a common vision.
Right.
And so there's some challenges there as well.
Just a few. And Iris Patton, my guest in the studio today from Rogue, is very familiar with this with cities around the country. When we come back, we're going to talk about how cities can organize private and civic wealth, 21st century funding mechanisms to take care of our cities that go beyond the traditional ways that we have thought. Some case studies from around the country that will apply to Tucson. We are talking Tucson here in the studio. Key ideas for the future of our city. We'll get into it on the other side of the break. You're on 1030 The Voice. Don't go away. Welcome back, Tucson, to the show where we talk about people and ideas shaping Tucson's future. 11 o'clock, our 11 o'clock hour is growing the Tucson pie hour. Cities are not broke. Don't believe the lie. Cities have more potential than ever to organize private and civic wealth to fund the stuff that needs to get done. For better or for worse, cities have probably not had so little help in a long time from the federal level. For better or for worse, and in some ways I actually think better, more power has been decentralized to cities to figure out ways to take care of themselves, because we're not getting much help from the federal level, we're not getting much help from the state level. But instead of whining about it, there are ways to capitalize on the private and civic wealth that we have in our cities to take care of the infrastructure and people needs that we have. And to talk about that in studio is Iris Patton. Thank you for being in studio today.
Anytime. It's just always fun to be here when I'm over-caffeinated.
Well, I have the most fun here when I'm over-caffeinated. This is idea juice, right?
There you go.
It is a staple of the show. And I just try to keep up with Bob. That's how Bob makes the magic happen, is six cups of coffee during this.
I say, did he have some coffee when he was picking his tie this morning? Because it's fabulous.
Hey, don't do that to our listening audience. They can't see this wonderful tie. That's not nice.
It is beautiful. I'm like, for real, I like it.
My daughter picked this one. My wife picked the other one, but you know.
Likely story.
I like it. She has good taste. It's like, I like it. I totally dig it.
We should have a tie week, Bob, where we come in our best ties.
And I'll wear Bermuda shorts and tank top.
Okay. It'll be
beach
week.
And I'll go home early with nausea.
Oh, man. We have fun here. Partly due to the coffee.
Yes, cheers.
Partly due to the fact that we all like each other. That's
exactly
a good thing. But Iris, I've got like 30 precious minutes with you to cover some things that you really have some incredible insight on.
Yeah.
Because you've been in Tucson for about 10 years.
Oh, goodness.
You have a passion for the city.
Yeah.
But you also work with other cities, and you've seen some best practices and case studies. Cities have used around the country private and civic resources to advance key community objectives, such as spurring entrepreneurship, redevelopment of critically located neighborhoods. You're involved in all of that. And I was looking at a model out of Cincinnati, I believe it's Cincinnati, called the Center City Development Corporation, where actually the municipal government, the local city government, and the private sector actually teamed up to form a 501c3 development corporation to be able to bring private dollars into developing different parts of the community. Cities are not broke. there are ways that cities can tap into resources. What are some ways that you've seen that happen to grow the pie in other cities, and how would that apply to Tucson?
So, you know, one of the key things that we tap into are social impact dollars or impact investing dollars. And so it's a way of taking private charitable dollars and funneling them to not just individual charities, but actually improving outcomes, addressing outcomes. And so then actually more than one charity might benefit from the private dollars that are out there. So to give you a sense of how much money is actually out there.
Okay.
So for charitable contributions, in a given year, on average, corporations, through their corporate social responsibility funds, typically give about $240 billion, that's what they be, dollars every year. Or they have that available. I'm sorry. They have that available. Typically, about half of that goes unexpended. And so then the corporations have no idea what to do with it. Either the projects that they're getting, they don't want to fund, or nobody's even asking. No one's asking for the right reasons. Now, there are these things called donor-advised funds, which is similar to, it's a private service or an investment service. So, you know, a lot of us are familiar with like 401ks or other types of ways to invest your money. It's a similar system that you go through a company with, whether it's like a bank or an investment house, and you have this money that you get the tax deduction from, the charitable contribution deduction from, and then you can then pick and choose where you want to spend the funds. Donor advised, meaning it's typically the donor that's saying, you know, I like cats, so I'm going to give to a charity that supports cats. And so then they work through the investment institution, whether it's a bank or someone else. The investment institution, depending upon which one it is, may often vet the organization for its stability or the ability to actually handle that investment. And then they'll pass the money along. You also have managed donor-advised funds where the organizations themselves actually provide some type of guidance in terms of where the funds should be donated. So if you say, I like cats, then the investment house may say, okay, well, we've already vetted X number of organizations, so we're going to kind of funnel your dollars into those organizations. The reason I bring them up is because they are a huge source of private funding that's available. So to give you a sense, the top two donor-advised funds in the U.S., it's Fidelity Charitable and Charles Schwab. Last year, they gave to 257,000 charities. And across those 257,000 charities, they contributed $14.5 billion. That's B with the billion.
Billion with a B.
Yes, billion with a B. So there's a ton of money out there. What we figured out in our organization is we're like, okay, this is a great idea. It's a great pool of funding, but let's do this differently. All of these models give to individual charities to support a program or to support whatever that mission is. We agree that that's important. But we believe that actually, if all this money is being given, why aren't outcomes improving or changing? Why do we have growing disparities in cities and not shrinking? And so our model actually helps identify outcomes that need to be improved in communities. And then we work with funding sources, whether they're corporate social responsibility folks or these donor-advised funds, and say, okay, if you have an interest in improving housing conditions or the poor, we want... If you invest in our model or contribute to our model, we will then work with the organizations, plural, that can then that will then address those outcomes. And our tools and kind of this high-touch guidance that we provide, it's all working toward changing the outcomes. We develop the solutions collaboratively. We monitor progress over multiple years. But it has to be a collaborative effort. Funding individual programs, it doesn't work. It's nice and it's good because any help is needed, but we need to start addressing outcomes. How are we going to start decreasing this gap, not, you know, continuing to perpetuate it?
For sure. So the so taking that to like the Cincinnati example, so the mayor there in 2003, this is a story, you probably know more about it than I do, and members of the Cincinnati corporate community got together and they formed a nonprofit entity together, a development fund. The operations are funded privately, It's a combination of corporate contributions, management fees, below market developer fees. They have a staff that operates it. And those loan funds are geared towards downtown redevelopment and economic development in distressed and struggling neighborhoods. It's a collaborative effort with the city of Cincinnati, the state of Ohio, the board, our corporate community members. In other words, it is a public good vision that brings the public and the private sector together to privately operate it, but to bring in a ton of these kind of dollars that you're talking about to advance broad mission and goals around these areas. Do you see this happening around the country? Do you get to work with these kind of groups or?
They do. So we work with them. We work in parallel with them.
Okay.
So in some cities, they'll be like the community development corporations like you're talking about. In other cities, they might be referred to as redevelopment authorities.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of kind of their equation is that on their boards, in addition to the corporations and the government entities, they also have representatives from the neighborhoods that they are addressing. And those representatives actually have a vote. And depending upon
it's
the
powerful.
It is. Depending upon the city and the organization, there's one in Massachusetts that I'm thinking of specifically. Typically, the residents who are on the boards aren't representative or aren't the heads of neighborhood associations. So they may be other invested individuals in the neighborhood. The CDC in Massachusetts, and I can't think of the name right now, but in addition to having this structured board, these structured board members, they also have a youth board as well. So that in addition to addressing, development, typical development needs, they have a keen eye on the future, and their youth group has a vote in what happens.
Mm.
And it's to ensure sustainability of these communities.
Right.
So that it's not just for who's there. But no, it works everywhere. The challenge, though, or it works in most places. The challenge with structures like this, though, and I think you hit on it, is that in addition to these groups coming together, there's also a financial contribution from the cities to support these CDCs. I'm not sure if it would work entirely here.
Hmm.
And given the structure that you've described.
Just that one example, yeah.
Yes, simply because since Tucson, and this is from my perspective, since Tucson is just coming out of kind of this challenging period, and they're now stable, and there's still a lot of financial challenges ahead of them, I'm not sure if they actually have the funds to support an organization like this. It also takes a lot of coordination and support locally. And again, from my opinion, is I think there are a lot of conflicting views about how Tucson should develop, and there really isn't a vision that's being followed. Again, like, it's not just you're putting this group together just to put them together and to develop. You're putting them together because you're trying to achieve some larger goals that are framed within a vision that everyone has accepted.
Right.
Tucson's completed a vision, and it's been integrated in lots of ways. But if you go ask a neighborhood association what the vision for Tucson is, they'll have no idea what you're talking about because it hasn't gained the traction at the community level that it has in a lot of these cities where the CDCs are quite effective.
Yep. And I want to be fair to neighbors, because neighbors often get a bad rap by folks who are not involved in neighborhoods and don't understand the dynamics of, you got a general plan that's supposed to be a vision, neighborhood plans that are supposed to ladder up to that vision, and then you have urban overlay districts. And just in a minute, an overlay can be put on or a change can be made. And so you've got neighbors who are spending literally years of equity of time and money to be a part of a supposed vision that can then just be pivoted super quick without neighborhood engagement. Yet when you don't have that, when you don't have the community buying into a vision and there's not a vision to buy into, that's why you have these anti-growth, pro-growth divisions and conversations. But we can do better than that. And it's stuff like this in my mind that gets us there.
So that's part of it. The other part of it, I think, is that I think the neighborhoods that I work with here or am familiar with here, there's a sense of resentment, and the sense of, it's like, okay, we've been here as neighbors investing in our community in various ways, whether that's helping to reduce crime, keeping our yards clean, trying to develop some type of community cohesiveness, writing grants to help do physical improvements. And so that investment is there, but yet I don't feel as though the neighbors believe that the city is on the same page as they are with trying to work toward a common vision. Even though, and they, I feel as though they don't feel like they're being heard, the residents. And so, you know, it reminds me of, like, my kid. I love him, I do. And, you know, and he'll have, like, these random conniptions. And and I'm like, you know, 5 seconds ago, you were fine. What's going on? And, you know, after he has his conniption, he starts to change his behavior, not necessarily in the best of way, but it's to protect himself. And then after we kind of talk through what the challenges were that, you know, initiated the conniption, you know, it usually comes down to the fact that he doesn't feel like he's being heard about something, or that, you know, his interests aren't the best ones that are mine. And I feel like that's kind of where we are with these neighborhoods and the city and the conflicts. You know, the neighbors may see all of this development coming into their communities, you know, and with this thought that this is the city's solution to addressing these challenges, to local challenges. But the neighborhoods are like, I've been here forever. You know, you're giving this guy a nice new park, or the only reason that we got a park is because of this new investment, or the only reason that we're getting improved schools is because of this new investment. We've been here forever dealing with all of these, you know, challenging situations and less than ideal circumstances, and you haven't given us anything. And so, like, what's our value? And so it's and so then they come out with developing these plans or revising these neighborhood plans. And then the plans are used as weapons instead of a mechanism to actually get toward this common vision. And it's terrible. It's really terrible.
And part of it is because Tucson's had to react for so long.
Yeah.
And has not had the opportunity to respond in the past, is what I like to say as well, that we haven't had options to respond to. And so as soon as we get, you know, we get options of different development opportunities or different economic development opportunities, we just kind of say yes to everything without a plan.
Yeah.
And I think we see that playing out. I'm curious, maybe we should go to a break and come back on this. So maybe kind of tie this into if you had to apply what you see to Tucson. You've mentioned things outside of our community that we're not ready to implement yet.
Yeah.
But for example, the city of Tucson has an $85 million line item budget for housing and community development. This is a line item. It's not broken down all what goes into that, but you speak about funding that the city would have to maybe contribute to, like, a CDC 501c3. Are there resources that the city has that could be applied towards even a small form of these public-private partnership opportunities that are seen around the city? I'd be curious to get your thoughts on what maybe opportunities you see Tucson having to grow our resource pie with what we have.
Okay, we'll do.
On the other side of the break, right?
Yes.
At this point, I want to thank Summers Financial Management, a wonderful sponsor of ours. They are an independent fee-only fiduciary, which means they always act in their clients' best interests, and they've been doing it for about 20 years. The guy who runs it, Adam Summers, has used the strategies that he teaches to grow his net worth from $250,000 to $3.5 million in just 8 years. Adam and his family are a wonderful addition to our Tucson community. And I say this in the best way because I think it's meaningful. He's just an average guy who's done some smart things with his finances and knows how to teach you how to do it as well. Another thing I love about him is he will give you an hour free of his time. He will meet you for an hour. Go to summersfinancial.com, set that up. He'll meet you for an hour, no strings attached. Talk with you about your either financial planning, your retirement planning, your wealth management strategy. If he can help and you like him and he likes you and you can work together, great. If not, he's just that generous to give you an hour of his time. So take him up on that. That's summersfinancial.com, summersfinancial.com. Summers with an O, not a U, with an O, summersfinancial.com. Let's go visit some more great sponsors. When we come back, we'll wrap up this hour with an application to Tucson. Tucson is not broke. We're just not using our resources in the best way possible. That's my thesis. Iris Patton is here to prove that true with her knowledge from working around the country on similar issues. And she's in Tucson and a great asset. And we'll talk more to close out our hour. Come on back, 10:30 The Voice. Tucson, welcome back to this fast-moving two-hour edition, Thursday edition of the Creative City Show, where every day we talk about people and ideas shaping Tucson's future. And we are talking about, in this hour, how cities are not broke. Do not buy into that lie that cities are broke. Our city isn't. Other cities aren't. We just don't always tap into the ways that we can grow our resource pie to tackle community and entrepreneurship efforts. And I have Iris Patton in the studio from Rogue Impact talking about ways that in her work in community and economic development around the country, she sees this working. We've talked community development corporations. We've also touched a bit on social impact funds. And around the country, for example, cities have, and it's not the only way to do it, but some cities at a city level have created social impact funds where local corporations can channel a portion of the tax windfall they reap from being in the city for investment in tax credit projects that build affordable housing, restore historic properties, rejuvenate business districts, rejuvenate neighborhoods. And it's a way to tap into public-private partnership to grow the resource pie. So we've talked big picture. We've got 7 minutes, close, 7-8 minutes. How would this apply to Tucson? What are some magic wand ideas for our city?
You know, I've been thinking about, you know, if it's
that you can give away for free.
Exactly. Free is the key word here. you know, I was thinking about its application and potential here in Tucson. And to be honest, I'm not sure if it's possible to do that public-private partnership here. My own perception, I would love for somebody to educate me on why I'm wrong, is that the only way to make something like this happen is if it was completely private. For example, we're working on a project in a local community here in Tucson, our local neighborhood here, and I reached out to somebody with the city, and I was like, hey, you know, we're doing this project. There's some of the challenges in the neighborhood include gentrification, you know, property tax increases, you know, they have low-income populations, so jobs and some other things. And I was like, you know, hey, your department is the one to help me with this so that I can keep these people in their homes and minimize displacement and still kind of further the larger goals. And the response from the city person was like, I don't see a problem. Everything's all good. I don't see the problem. You don't really need my help. If there was a problem, I would have addressed it. And I'm like, okay, then you're not the person for me to talk to. And instead, what we've kind of chosen to do is instead we're trying to raise private capital in order to achieve these goals and do as much as we can outside of government. And then when we need them, we will talk to them. Because there are, what you see in a lot of cities, and I love Tucson, I do, what you see in a lot of cities is that there's an acknowledgement of the problem, and the government, local government understands that there are creative ways and they're interested in these creative, innovative ways to implement policy that would help to address or temper the pace of these negative changes. I'm not sure that's here. In several meetings I've attended, there's some acknowledgement that there's a problem, but I feel like there's an overwhelming sense of the problem. The problem is just too big, or the local government feels as though the problem is too big. But in reality, it really isn't. You know, that's what these other cities and their models are for. So you can take them, tweak them, and apply them locally. And so in our pursuit of trying to get this done without city funds, we're looking to social impact dollars. So we're looking to private corporations using some of the dollars that they have to then invest in our neighborhoods. They may get a return on the back end. It may be completely philanthropic, but the entire time, kind of the benefit to them is financial, yes, but it's also, we can actually quantify the income, the impact that they've made on the outcomes. We're looking at also private philanthropy dollars through the donor advised funds, whether that's working with like a Chase Bank or a large investment house or whomever, and say, okay, your donors, instead of giving to a charity, a specific charity for a specific program about helping cats, you know, how about we like, you know, work on changing outcomes and start to kind of pool all of our resources and interests and then start to address changing and funding outcome improvement and decreasing the disparity that way. There are a lot of cities, we're going to start working on a project in Gainesville. And what's really cool about them is there is an understanding from their community foundation. It's a community foundation. It's a local nonprofit that's in partnership with the newspaper. And actually the newspaper, their local newspaper, is leading the charge on this. And then Cox Communications locally in Gainesville is also a major partner. And again, they've shifted from their approach to getting funds from just, oh, we're funding a program, to, oh, we're changing outcomes. And those three entities, the newspaper, Cox, and the Community Foundation, are the ones that are championing this shift in the approach and of the narrative. And that's helping to better funnel and channel funds to outcomes, private funds that they have access to. And so it's been kind of cool. So there are ways to do it, but you have to kind of think beyond the typical.
Right.
And understand that if you access, whether it's private funds or whatever, the old way of doing it isn't going to work anymore. If we don't tap into it, new sources of funding and change the narrative of what we're funding and how we're funding it and what the end goal is, we're going to continue to live in a community where the disparities increase, where there's a stagnating middle class, a stagnating lower class, and you continue to import talent. I mean, it's not sustainable.
Right.
And so you're going to have to change your tactics.
Absolutely. And Tucson, by the way, is on a importing talent trajectory. If you think that the companies and jobs coming to Tucson are going to hire Tucsonans, I think you're wrong. And that's not me trying to be a shock jock. That's not me throwing shade at any company or business. There's still a talent workforce development issue in the city. And I'm just telling you, in conversations I'm having and meetings I'm having out there, I think the path to new businesses in Tucson hiring local talent, we're farther away than you would think. That's just a little warning out there.
Yeah. And that's why, again, you need to change the approach to how you're funding quality of life improvement, from going from funding just programs to funding changing the outcomes. If I have a low educated existing resident workforce, then I need to change their outcomes so that they are improving themselves and they're elevating themselves, so that then I can start to draw talent from within.
Right.
So how do I, retain the University of Arizona graduates who are coming from California and spending their money at UA, but then they leave as soon as they actually have the potential to make a lot of money and generate a lot of money in my community?
Right. Man, I love this conversation because we're not buying in for the lie that cities are broke.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, the conversation of what the state is limiting us on, the state legislature, it drives me up a wall because cities have more power. Our city has more power than we've had in a long time to, as weird as that sounds, to tap into these innovative ways to fund and support our cities. We're out of time.
Can I throw one last thing?
Yeah, 15 seconds. Yes.
So, and the answer is not to attract an Amazon. That is my last parting word.
Well, I'm going to end there.
I am.
We don't have another hour, Iris.
It's not because that's a recipe for disaster. That is not the answer.
Got to grow from the inside.
Yep.
I love this quote. I've been chewing on it for a minute. The man who will improve the place is the man who loves it without a reason. Can he hate it enough to change it and yet love it enough to think it worth changing? G.K. Chesterton.
Story of my life.
I figured that's why I brought it up. I figure you would resonate, Iris. Thank you for your work in Tucson. Thank you for your work around the country. Thank you for your innovative ideas and bringing them here to the show. Tucson, that has been our Tucson Hour, focused on big picture ideas and looking at our resources to make change where it counts. Stay tuned for the 12 o'clock hour. The Bill Buckmaster Show is coming up. And then tomorrow, Friday, we'll wrap up the week talking about people and ideas shaping Tucson's future. You're on 1030 The Voice. Thanks for tuning into the Creative City Show. We'll see you tomorrow.